Hello and welcome to Spotlight on Transitional Justice. This is a podcast that will attempt to explore how a country like Ukraine can achieve justice in the face of atrocities committed during and since the Russian invasion. In today's episode, we'll be discussing one of the most important topics in this context for Ukraine, the challenges of prosecuting international crimes committed during this conflict. As it is well known, accountability for crimes such as war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide is crucial not only for achieving justice against direct perpetrators of these crimes, but for building a culture that fights impunity and provides a sort of a historical record, or contributes to a historical record that prevents revisionism. Or in the case of Ukraine, where the conflict is still ongoing, prevents various attempts at disinformation about what is taking place in this regard. Today, we are very fortunate to be joined by Howard Varney, barrister practicing at the Johannesburg Bar, who in the early 1990s was an attorney with the legal resources in Durban, where he represented victims of political violence committed during the apartheid in South Africa. Later, he oversaw an independent criminal investigation in South Africa into state-sponsored political violence on behalf of the police ministry. He was the chief investigator for the Sierra Leone Truth and Reconciliation Commission and has worked in various post-conflict settings around the world. And today, we will get Howard to share his insights on how Ukraine can navigate the many challenges ahead in prosecuting international crimes. Howard, thank you very much for dedicating the time to join us today.
It's great to be with you, Rafik.
Let's launch straight into it and begin with sort of a foundational question on fair and transparent legal proceedings and the importance of them in these accountability efforts. In Ukraine, it is very clear there is a real thirst for justice, but sometimes the efforts to speed up trials and cases in the context of international crimes can be counterproductive. From your experience, why is it so important the prosecutions of international crimes be conducted with utmost fairness, transparency, even in the face of the ongoing conflict, where victims are actually being killed daily, and there is a huge desire for swift justice in these cases?
So what one can certainly understand the desire and the need for justice in the context of Ukraine, where mass atrocity is being committed almost on a daily basis, and civilians are being targeted across the country. And it is tragic to see this unfolding saga in which very serious crimes are being committed, including war crimes, crimes against humanity, not to mention a host of other serious offences. When it comes to adopting a fair approach, quite frankly, fair procedure and respect for the rights of all individuals in the criminal justice process, including, of course, those facing justice, the suspects, the accused, is absolutely necessary if you want the process to have any credibility amongst the eyes of the citizens, amongst those facing justice, and in the eyes of the international community. There really is nothing worse, whether it be at the domestic level or at the international level, when you have justice that does not respect basic fair procedure, does not allow individuals to be heard and to present their cases in an unhindered manner. It's also a question of nation building. You know, what kind of future society do you want to build? Do you want to set the kinds of precedents where it's okay to take shortcuts, where it's okay to abuse the rights of individuals who are facing justice? If it's okay in one context, it becomes okay in another context. And that is a slippery road that one doesn't want to go down. So I think it's absolutely necessary to introduce the necessary standards and to stick with them, even if it means that in some cases you're unable to pursue cases because you don't meet the evidential burden, or because certain rules will require the exclusion of evidence in some circumstances.
On this note, what in your opinion and your experience lessons can be relevant for Ukraine from international examples as it pursues accountability for the crimes committed during Russian invasion?
Well, there's certainly no shortage of experience around the world. We've seen since the mid-20th century pretty strenuous attempts to achieve justice for very serious crimes, as we saw take place in Nazi Germany. We've seen the Nuremberg trials, the Tokyo trials, and then through the 20th century and in this century as well, attempts to hold those responsible for the worst known crimes. With mixed success, one has to say. Yes, we have seen some notable examples with the International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, in which hundreds have faced trial and many have been convicted. We have seen, though, that the pursuit of criminal cases is often done on a very selected basis by necessity, because resources are typically in short supply. And I think Ukraine is embarking on its own journey to achieve justice. I should make a disclaimer. I haven't been to Ukraine. I don't regard myself as a Ukraine specialist, but from what I've observed at a distance, I think the country is moving in the right direction and is looking at experiences from a range of other countries. And it's quite pleasing to see justice being pursued at the different levels, through the domestic courts, through regional courts, through the International Criminal Court, and even through cases adopted by some countries under the universal jurisdiction principle. So there's obviously much to be done, and it's a long process, but you have to start somewhere, and the collection of information, documentation, preservation of evidence is certainly the starting point.
There are two elements that are specifically challenging when it comes to Ukraine, and perhaps there are some lessons that can be looked to perhaps in terms of what has worked or what has not worked in the international experience. One of those is the fact that perpetrators of crimes committed by Russian forces are to a large degree outside of the reach of Ukrainian courts at this point in time, and are likely to be protected by the Russian authorities. I myself have worked for the ICTY at a time when this was an international court, and many of the perpetrators were outside of its reach because of non-cooperation by states like Serbia. Today, this is the case in many of the cases that are pursued by local courts in Bosnia for what happened during the 90s, where perpetrators flee to either Croatia or Serbia and seek protection due to their dual nationality and unwillingness of these states to send them back. Then there are situations like East Timor, where you are very familiar with the same approach taken by Indonesia. Can you discuss these examples, especially the one in East Timor, in terms of its relevance to the challenges that Ukraine is facing?
So this is one of the biggest challenges in international justice, is securing suspects in order to stand trial. So it has been a challenge, as you point out, in places such as Bosnia and elsewhere. And it also was the case with the serious crimes process in East Timor. For those who don't know, that country was occupied by Indonesia for many years. Lots of atrocities were committed, particularly against those resisting the occupation. And when East Timor eventually secured its independence with the assistance of the United Nations and the international community, a serious crimes process was set up, which included a special prosecutor's office and the setting up of special courts within the East Timorese judiciary. It was a hybrid approach. They were also foreign judges, also senior foreign staff in the prosecutor's office and the investigation department. And by and large, they did pretty good work. They did issue indictments in a few hundred cases, actually. But they were only able to pursue suspects who were members of Indonesian-aligned militia who were still based in East Timor. The bulk of the suspects, of course, were in Indonesia, particularly the senior suspects, including senior officers and generals and the like. Needless to say, Indonesia refused to hand over any of them to face trial. So the best that they could do was to simply issue the indictments in open court and then seek notices through Interpol, one may argue, well, what was the point of all that? And I suggest that there was a lot of point in still doing that. In the first place, you've established in an unofficial historical record that indictments of serious crimes were issued against these individuals, and that has become publicized globally, so their role has become well known. Secondly, their ability to pursue a normal lifestyle is restricted somewhat. They're no longer able to travel to countries for purposes of holidays or shopping or to see family in places where they could potentially be arrested and handed over to judicial authorities. So that in itself, of course, is not the full criminal justice that most people would want, but it is a small measure of accountability, a small measure of justice, which frankly is better than doing nothing. So in the case of Ukraine, issuing indictments against Russian soldiers accused of carrying out war crimes and crimes against humanity, and in certain cases, genocide, Ukraine will face the same problem. Russia will be protecting those individuals and will not hand them over. But again, certainly at the symbolic level, I think issuing the indictments is important. And it also means that their freedom is somewhat restricted when it comes to travel and leaving Russia. And I think those steps should be taken. And of course, you never know what's going to happen in the future. You simply don't know whether there is going to be regime change or not. And perhaps if there is, then there may be the opportunity for justice to take its course. And then, of course, you do want to have the work done, the indictments issued, and to be ready to take those cases up.
It is about shrinking the space for impunity with a view of the full justice being possible to be served. I absolutely agree with you, and it is also about building political alliances that will always keep this issue at the top of the agenda in any future negotiations that may occur. You talked about something that I found very important in the context of these cases, and that is setting the historical record straight, and perhaps we could talk about that somewhat. I have worked for the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, which has contributed hugely through its investigations and court cases to kind of erect this wall against revisionism, which is rampant in the former Yugoslavia at the moment due to various different political agendas. In Ukraine, this is not something that is about what happened in the past. This is also something very cancerous, I would say, when it comes to disinformation about crimes that are being committed at the moment, dehumanization, and actually creating a platform in which these crimes are committed. How important do you think is that Ukraine's legal proceedings contribute to this historical account of the atrocities committed, and why the fairness and transparency of proceedings is important in this context?
Well, I think the criminal justice process has much to contribute to establishing an historical record. And as you know from your experiences in the ICTY, there's an immensely important and rich record that has been produced by the investigators, prosecutors, and in the judicial proceedings that followed. That's an incredibly significant record that will stand the test of time when it comes to looking back at what took place in the Balkans through those years in the 1990s. There are, of course, drawbacks in relying exclusively on the criminal process to establish an impartial and an accurate historical record of the past. So, for example, although the ICTY has been able to put on the table literally tens of thousands of important facts and has played an important role in verifying those facts, can it be said that the work of the ICTY has in fact established a complete historical record that really interrogates the underlying issues, whether it be of a socio-political and economic nature, whether it be ethno-nationalism that swept that region? I think that is debatable. And if one looks at the trajectory of the cases taken through the ICTY system, certainly in the beginning, I think there was an intention to engage in that broader truth-seeking. And when it comes to certain offences charged, such as crimes against humanity, there was a requirement, of course, to show that these crimes were committed on a systematic or widespread basis. But the courts soon ran into issues. Yes, they did call a number of experts in history, sociology, who were keen academics who understood the deep divisions in that society, but much of that was challenged. And then ultimately, from what I can pick up, the courts were forced to focus on the elements of the crime. And I do recall one judge even saying they're not here to fact-check history. They're here to establish whether the elements of each crime were committed or not. So that does point to some limitations in relying on a criminal justice process to establish the historical record. I think courts and the criminal justice process have an incredibly important role to play and to feed into that historical record. But I do think more is needed, both on the part of the state as well as civil society, to fill in those gaps and to engage in truth-seeking at an individual level, individual cases, at the community level, and then at the national level, and dare I say, at a regional level as well.
Fully agree, Howard. I fully agree. And the concept that is crucial in the discussion of justice in Ukraine, in my opinion, is the kind of holistic view of various different aspects of what constitutes justice. And it is very understandable that the overwhelming focus at a time when people are still being, as I mentioned, killed as we record this, is on criminal justice, but that must not come at the expense of these other aspects of justice, including truth that you mentioned. But let me ask you about the second element. We talked about the fact that many of the perpetrators will be probably out of reach, at least for some time in the beginning, to Ukrainian courts. But the second and related factor to this is something that you are actually dealing with currently, these days, and that is the passage of time. In South Africa, you are now involved in some of the apartheid-related cases decades after the crimes were committed. What challenges does that present for the successful prosecution of these crimes, and are there any lessons for Ukraine to make a note of?
So the passage of time does present enormous challenges to pursuing justice. And the biggest, most obvious one is that, you know, the longer you wait, the less prospect of securing justice, simply because people get old and die. We've seen that in South Africa. We've seen that in countries throughout Latin and South America. We've seen that in famous cases arising from Nazi Germany. The longer you wait, the more difficult it is to pursue justice, the more difficult it is to extract and preserve evidence, the more difficult it is to track down witnesses. If you're dealing with cases that are many years old, in some cases decades old, even if you do find witnesses and suspects. Obviously, with the passage of time, memories fade. People can't quite remember the detail like they used to. Documentation and artifacts and forensic evidence also erode over time, or go missing, or get destroyed, get concealed. So these are challenges we're facing in South Africa. Most of our cases date back to the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s. We're focusing mostly on the 1980s, with a few from the early 1990s. And so the suspects we are pursuing are typically well into their mid to late 70s, many in their 80s, and some already in their 90s. And we've had a number of cases where, you know, we're on the verge of, presenting dockets, only to find that, you know, the last remaining suspect dies. And you can imagine how devastating this is for families who've been struggling and pursuing and waiting for justice all this time. Of course, in South Africa, we've had to face the additional challenge that there has been something of a political conspiracy to close down these cases. And in fact, I'm working on a case right now in which we're asking the courts to compel the president of South Africa to establish an independent commission of inquiry to look into the suppression of the cases. Because not long after the winding up of our Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it appears that discussions were held, some claimed deals were made between the old order and the new order, that all the cases would simply be swept under the carpet. Your listeners might recall that we had this quite famous amnesty process, Truth for Amnesty: disclose the truth, you get your amnesty. If you don't disclose the truth, you were meant to face the consequences. And by and large, that has not happened. And when cases could have gone ahead, post the winding up of the Truth Commission at the end of the 1990s, early 2000s, when most suspects and witnesses were still alive and available, that's when justice should have been pursued, but it wasn't. And here we are, you know, more than 20, some nearly 30 years later, and we're trying to assist families to pursue justice, and it's a race against time. The clock is ticking, and quite frankly, it's a battle that we are losing. We're still pursuing cases where we can, but we don't always get the support of the authorities. Some of the families believe that the political interference that closed down the cases, they accuse the government of still obstructing cases. So this is something I think, you know, Ukraine should take note of. Justice never happens quickly. It is a long-term process. You know, gathering evidence and putting cases together is a meticulous exercise. However, you know, it should be done as soon as it can be. And if you do wait many years, even decades, then you will be letting people down. The work should be done now, and where you can, put together cases.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Howard, but just to pick up on this specific issues of the importance of gathering evidence at the time that it is possible, of course, but immediately after these crimes take place. This is a case in Ukraine as the conflict is still going on. And in this particular context, what would you say are the biggest challenges of ensuring that this evidence can stand up in court, considering that it comes mostly from conflict zones?
Well, in the articles that I've read and some of the footage I've seen, it does seem to me that Ukraine's Prosecutor General's office is already doing what you would expect prosecutors to do. So at the scene of these crimes, whether they be bombings of civilian targets, extrajudicial executions, massacres, and the like, from what I can see, prosecutors and investigators are getting onto the scenes as quickly as possible and doing your classic crime scene investigations, preserving that evidence, and then doing what we sometimes refer to as the structural investigations to look at the universe of possible suspects, and to use both open source information as well as intelligence gathering in order to put together the chain of command and the structural environment in which these crimes were committed. So to do that work as quickly as possible following the crimes is the right way to go, because then you are doing what you can to preserve the evidence, taking statements from witnesses, getting the best possible descriptions of the potential suspects, working with the international community to gather enough information to start pinpointing who those potential suspects are and to work your way up the known chain of command. And then putting together the dockets and then ultimately the indictments, even if for the foreseeable future those suspects are out of reach. At least that hard work has been done, because to try to do that 10, 20 years later down the road is very difficult and sometimes impossible. So that, you know, that's the big lesson for Ukraine, is to do that hard work now, rather than leaving it for decades later. But from what I can see, of course, with the limited resources at their disposal and working in very tough and adverse conditions, it seems to me that work has started. And I'm very pleased to see that happening.
One aspect that you just mentioned that is of crucial importance is international cooperation. And we can see that Ukraine is indeed receiving support from a variety of international actors in the pursuit of justice, including the International Criminal Court, other national courts. How important is international cooperation in prosecuting crimes of this magnitude? And in your opinion, what challenges might Ukraine face in ensuring that this cooperation is effective?
Well, the international community has a really important role to play in supporting the pursuit of justice in Ukraine. So it is good to see that the International Criminal Court has acted quite expeditiously in the pursuit of justice in Ukraine. Of course, the ICC has been criticized for not acting as expeditiously in other countries, but that's a debate for another time. The European Union has also been playing an important role in supporting justice initiatives in Ukraine, and then individual countries have also done important work in coming up with universal jurisdiction cases. I think some indictments have already been issued in countries such as Lithuania and the US. But you know, given the scale of the violations, I think this would be a tough task for any individual country to deal with exclusively on their own. You know, we're not dealing with a few hundred violations. We're dealing with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of very serious offences that have taken place over the last few years. That's surely enough to overwhelm any criminal justice system. So the international community, I think, does have an obligation to assist their colleagues in Ukraine, be it by way of financial support, expertise, and assistance in putting together cases together, both at the domestic level, but also at the international level. Ukraine must be primarily responsible for pursuing justice in their own country and in their own courts, to the extent that they can. But in certain cases, I think it is important for the international community to step in, as we have seen through the indictments issued against Vladimir Putin, as well as the senior command of the Russian military. And frankly, I think we need to see more indictments, also down the chain of command as well. I think it's important to send a message that those at the top must be held responsible, but also those also down the chain of command, because often it's middle management who could prevent these violations from taking place, but they happily go ahead and are culpable in needlessly targeting civilians, and indeed soldiers on the ground who are caught executing, for example, Ukrainian soldiers who have surrendered. Regardless of their rank, they need to be pursued. They need to be held responsible. And at some point in the future, as I mentioned earlier, who knows what will happen? The opportunity may arise. But let's get that groundwork done now so that should the opportunity arise down the road, we are ready to pursue these cases.
Let me, as we look to conclude this conversation, ask you a couple of more questions that I think are of great importance. And one of them is the role of victims and witnesses. What would be your advice to Ukraine's legal community on how to engage victims and witnesses in a way that acknowledges their suffering and provides them with a sense of justice, considering all the challenges that we talked about so far?
So this is quite a big challenge, and of course will be a big challenge in Ukraine, given the scale of the atrocities and given the fact that you're in the grip of hostilities, you're in the grip of a full-scale war. Nonetheless, victims must be brought into the process. And as you say, they must be acknowledged. And the best way to do this is to involve them in the criminal justice process, is not to regard them as bystanders and as witnesses to be used from time to time in cases. So in the preliminary investigations, they should be brought on board, their views should be heard, and efforts should be made to ensure that they have their own representation, that they have some agency in the way that these cases are pursued. I understand that Ukraine has a civil law tradition that employs both inquisitorial perspectives as well as an adversarial nature, particularly when it comes to criminal trials. I also understand that the system does allow for victim participation, and this should be upheld where possible, because where victims have a role to play in these proceedings, then they can take some ownership of the process, and they can pursue justice. You know, we often find, and I found this in South Africa, but also working in countries like Timor and Sierra Leone, the cases that typically see the light of day are the ones where the victims themselves, not only have they agitated for justice, but they've also done some investigations. They've worked with civil society organizations, both local and international. Investigators and researchers have gotten involved. Typically, it's those cases that are first generated by the victims, the families, supported by civil society and NGOs who really do the groundwork. And often they present cases that are close to ready-made to prosecutors. Those are typically the cases that end up in court and the ones that are most likely to result in successful outcomes. So I think involving victims, their communities and grassroots organizations is a good idea. It does provide the acknowledgement, it recognizes that they have a role to play. And at a practical level, I believe it's those cases that typically make it to courts, and often successfully so.
Thank you, Howard. Before we wrap up this very informative, I think, and useful conversation for our Ukrainian colleagues, let me ask you, what in your opinion are the key milestones that Ukrainians should aim for or expect in the coming years when it comes to accountability efforts and the effort to for these cases to remain credible, fair, impactful, if you will? But also, what would be your message to the Ukrainian public in terms of what they need to understand about the challenges of prosecuting international crimes, particularly in the context of the ongoing conflict?
Well, my message to the Ukrainian people, Ukrainian families who've suffered the loss of loved ones, so many of them, is not to give up the fight for justice, to preserve the memory of those who have died fighting for the freedom of Ukraine. The criminal justice process is the starting point. I'd like to see very close collaboration between families, communities, prosecution authorities, both domestic and international. The need to continue with on-the-ground documentation for purposes of building these cases. The need for wider truth-seeking outside of the criminal justice program. The need to fill in those gaps, the need to understand where this conflict came from, to look at its historical roots. So to engage in this wider truth-seeking, while at the same time ensuring that the most serious cases up and down the chain of command are pursued, and those cases are fully investigated, where you can to issue those indictments, have them waiting, and to show at the end of the day that human rights violations and aggression will be held to account in some form or another. And to always remember that Ukraine is on the right side of history, and the world knows that.
On that note, I will not add anything further, but only thank you, Howard Varney, for speaking to us and being the first guest to appear in the Spotlight on Transitional Justice, a podcast that discusses justice efforts in Ukraine. Thank you.
It has been a privilege. Thank you, Rafiq.